FilmSpotting SVU is presented by Movies on Demand on Cable, bringing the latest indie movies into your home at the touch of a button.
Cutie and the Boxer, a documentary about famed boxing painter Ushio Shinohara and his wife/assistant Noriko, premieres on demand this week. And on December 24th, watch the story of a man with memory loss, a group of strangers, and a pit of dead bodies in Open Grave, available on demand before it hits theaters.
The latest independent films are ready when you are with Movies on Demand on Cable. The Art House is now in your house.
From New York City, this is Film Spotting Streaming Video Unit. I'm Matt Singer.
And I'm Allison Wilmore. Coming up on this week's show, spring break lasts forever, or at least the next 75 minutes or so. Our listener's choice review is Harmony Korine's Spring Breakers.
Later in the show, we'll bring you Cue Shots, where we recommend some titles you can rent or stream at home right now, all centered around a common theme. Inspired by Spring Breakers, Allison was pushing really hard this week for an entire episode about star Vanessa Hudgens, as the founder, president, secretary, and treasurer of the Brooklyn chapter of the official Vanessa Hudgens fan club, which, of course, is named, everyone knows, the Hudgies. Allison, you were really hoping to put your 7 years of hardcore V-Hudge fandom to good use, and you were also hoping I would let you sing the entire soundtrack to High School Musical, but I, in the interest of fairness, demanded equal time for a Zac Efron podcast where I, as the founder, president, secretary, treasurer, and man-at-arms of the Brooklyn chapter of the official Zac Efron fan club, which, of course, is named, that's right, Efrontery, could extol the virtues of my beloved Zeffy. Well, it all, you just backed off because you didn't want to do it. You said that was too much. You couldn't have both.
It would have been unfair.
Yeah.
Unfair to the Hudgies.
That's right. And, you know, I couldn't do that to Zeffy and my fellow members of Efrontery. So instead, we compromised on a podcast focused on the life and career of a different Spring Breaker star, Mr. James Franco. But first up is Opening Break, a segment we do in conjunction with our sponsor, Movies on Demand on Cable, in which we spotlight a few notable films new on demand. Allison, what's our first pick this week?
Well, the first film I'm going to highlight is a film. It's one of those rare cases where I actually like the remake of a film better than its original.
Ooh.
And that film is We Are What We Are, which is available on demand on December 17th, so likely by the time you hear this. It's a remake of a 2010 Mexican horror film of the same name by Jorge Michel Grau. And the original film is definitely a beautiful, kind of haunting, but also it felt to me slightly underdeveloped film about a family of cannibals who are living in Mexico City. The film is kind of filled with this clock imagery and this idea of urban decay and chaos. The American version moves this to a rural setting where the ritualized cannibalism fits into this kind of like fundamentalism of the region. And it definitely fills out its own mythology a little more, which I think in this case is to the film's benefit. It's directed by Jim Mickle, who did Stakelands, and it just manages to be a great slow burn in which you start to understand why this small family is so unusual, especially after the death of its matriarch, and kind of gets more and more of a sense of urgency as we approach the ritual in question.
Daddy! Mama's gone.
Better place, he calls us.
Amen.
We will carry on. We've kept our tradition in its purity. We do it the way that we've always done it. Iris is the eldest. It's her responsibility now.
You ready for that? That's the way it works.
It's got a good bit of gore at the end, but it also just builds the tension slowly and wonderfully. And I think really does service to this very creepy idea of cannibals living among us and of cannibalism as this religious kind of ceremony. So that's We Are What We Are, and it is available on demand December 17th. also available on demand. Two films I have not seen yet, but I'm very interested in because of the people involved. The first up is Hours, which is currently available on demand, and it stars the late Paul Walker, who, you know, recently passed away. And many people have described it as his one of his finest performances. It's written and directed by Eric Hesserer, and it's a film that premiered at South by Southwest and set during Hurricane Katrina, where Paul Walker plays the father of a newborn baby who finds himself having to try and keep his infant daughter alive inside an incubator after the hospital's power goes out due to the storm. And so, you know, Walker starred famously in a lot of blockbusters, but he did on occasion star in some smaller movies that showed off that he was more than just a kind of good-looking action star. And this is supposed to be one of those films. And the other film I have to recommend is Wrong Cops. It is available on demand on December 20th. And it premiered at Sundance this year, written and directed by Quentin Dupieux, who directed Rubber, which you may remember is the film about the tire, the sentient tire of destruction. This is about a group of crooked cops who look to dispose of a body that one of them accidentally killed. And it stars, among other people, Marilyn Manson, Steve Little from Eastbound and Down, Grace Zabriskie, and Eric Wareheim of Tim and Eric. So with that kind of collection of people, it has to be at least somewhat interesting, if I'm sure incredibly strange. So that is Wrong Cops, and it is available on demand December 20th. I fly like paper, get high like planes. If you catch me at the border, I got visas in my name. If you come around here, I'll make a more day. I get one down in a second if you wait. I fly like paper, get high like planes. If you catch me at the border, I got visas in my name. If you come around here, I'll make a more day. I get one down in a second if you wait.
All right, our topic for Q Shots on this episode is James Franco, the star of Spring Breakers, the star of Freaks and Geeks, a show that we love and have talked about on this podcast before. I think that's still streaming on Netflix. Star of many, many big movies. He's a writer, a director now. He's a student of, I think, most of the major higher learning centers on this continent.
And a teacher.
He's pursuing PhDs and master's degrees all over the country, multiple ones at the same time. He's an artist. He's a gallery artist. He is a very interesting figure. I mean, Allison, do you have any general things you want to say, first of all, about Mr. Franco?
Well, it's interesting to me that he's become this postmodern movie star, which is to say, like, he's more interested in reflecting on and kind of deconstructing the idea of movie stardom than he is actually being a movie star most of the time. You know, like, his big starring role in a traditional blockbuster this year was in Oz the Great and Powerful, in which he did not do, like, a riveting job in that lead role. He seems much more alive in either of these very academic kind of approaches to, you know, different topics in either in terms of either, like, representation or art, or in playing himself. And it seems to be it's a really strange thing for an actor to have ended up in. But especially someone who has proven, you know, in Freaks and Geeks particularly, which I think is still probably his best straightforward role, that he can be a really good, both like a good leading man in a maybe traditional sense and a great comic actor.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I don't know what to make of the many, many different pursuits of Franco. It's bewildering to me.
He is a really strange guy. And I mean, one of the things that I found really fascinating as I was getting ready to talk about him on this podcast is, look, you know, even doing this job, even watching, you know, a dozen movies a week or so, there are still movies I haven't seen, but it's hard to release a movie that I've never heard of. And James Franco has made all kinds of movies I've never even heard of. And they're available on Netflix. He has two different movies on Netflix, Allison. for streaming that I'd never even heard of. One of them is called The Broken Tower, and that's that was like his thesis film from NYU, and he wrote and directed and stars in it as this real life poet from like
Park
the
19th, right?
Yeah, from the 1930s exactly. And then he's also got this other one that he made, I think, with one of his professors from NYU, where he's one of the stars of it, and that's called The Letter. And I just watched a few minutes of both of these, and neither one really jumped out to me as a particularly fascinating movie where I wanted to make it one of my picks. But I mean, he's an interesting guy for a lot of reasons, but one of them I find interesting is that he does so much stuff. It's like he is one of the most prolific people around right now, and he seems completely, or maybe not completely, but largely uninterested in like the reception of these things. It's like, you know, it's not like he's going way out of his way to promote them to the high heavens. He's really interested in making these things. He wants to do, and he's not all that interested or less interested in, you know, the promotional aspects of this. Now, of course, if he makes a big Hollywood movie, like if when he makes Oz, I'm sure he did a junket for Oz or whatever. But he's just like cranking these things out as objects, and he's a little less concerned with how they're necessarily received, which I find kind of interesting as well.
Yeah, and he's also made a lot of, I mean, in addition to other things, I didn't even mention, but, you know, he has the movie coming up, Palo Alto, which is based on his own collection of short stories in which he also stars. But that he, you know, has made a lot of films that are about filmmaking or about, like, images on screen.
About,
you know,
art.
Like, about art. Well, I mean, like, he was in Interior Leather Bar, right, mm-hmm. which is, like, a replication of a missing like the cut sequence in Cruising.
Right.
That was supposedly those minutes that were cut to get it an R rating as opposed to an NC-17 rating.
Right.
That become this kind of meta commentary on sexuality and what they're comfortable with, what he's comfortable with. You know, he's starred in, for whatever reason, a Nickelodeon telenovela called Hollywood Heights. He appeared in 6 episodes. No one knows why. you know, he made a film about Sal Mineo. He's played James Dean in another film. You know, he worked with Gus Van Sant on those two. I think they were kind of installations about River Phoenix.
Mm-hmm.
So he's very aware of the idea of acting and representations on screen as well, or at least very interested in it. I don't know if any of these projects so far have brought up a lot of like deep insight into these topics, or at least anymore, given his place as a major movie star. Do you feel like you understand who James Franco is,
Pat? That's an interesting question. No, and it's an interesting question because he specifically does so much as himself. You know, like he makes James Franco the character in so much of his work, and yet I don't feel like I really have a great grasp on who that guy is, you know, that he's done these things where he talks about himself as this idea in quotes, like James Franco in quotes, but I don't ever really get the sense that I'm really understanding who he is necessarily, so much as I'm getting a sense of the idea that he uses himself as like his own, like as an extension of his art, or if James Franco in air quotes is a work of art unto itself, you know, like that it's this ongoing art project that he's creating, which includes all of this different stuff, his career, his celebrity, like everything he does is all part of this thing. And amongst the more eccentric things he's done is one of my picks. But I mean, he's called some of these things that he's done like performance art. And you wonder if he does some of these things just for that reason, just to see what happens, just as experiments, you know, like he may very well be the most popular, like experimental film artist in the world right now. Although I don't know that the people that are fans of him would necessarily think of him that way. But if you just think about like the sheer the reach that he has, the broad reach that he has, and that some of his weirder things have been seen by, I think you'd have to put him in that category of like really popular experimental artists. You know, people who make their living making experimental art might be infuriated to hear me say that, but I think he kind of is a force to be reckoned with nonetheless.
Yeah, I agree. And I do admire the amount of work he's willing to put out there in this way that's kind of fearless, that as you said, he doesn't seem that worried about whether or not people are going to praise it.
Right.
And he also, we should mention before we move on, he's been writing criticism of movies.
Oh, that's right.
Vice. He has like a column there.
So. Yes. He's reviewed his own movies, in fact. He reviewed Spring Breakers.
Yeah.
He reviewed Spring Breakers and had – here's a shocker, Allison. He had very positive things to say about it.
I can't believe that.
Can you believe it? Yeah. I mean we tease him a little bit, and I'm sure you know that's going to happen some more over the course of the show. But he really has, in a weird way, become a bit of a punchline to some extent. You know, he seems like an easy target, I think, because he does so much weird stuff. But I actually admire him too, and I think he does kind of get a bad rap. I mean, he is a guy who's made big Hollywood movies, certainly, and still does, obviously. He made several this year, including Oz, which I didn't hate. But he, you know, he's willing to experiment, and you rarely get the sense that he's doing paycheck jobs just for the paycheck. You know, that usually he brings something interesting to them. Even if the movie isn't great, he is usually interesting in them. And if nothing less, it's fun to try to figure out what he's doing in these things. Like, why did he host the Oscars?
Yeah, I don't know.
I mean,
I really don't know.
I mean, it was really something. I mean, I think James Franco has some skills, which I'm sure we'll talk about over the course of our picks. But to me, it's like, you know, gregarious master of ceremonies is not necessarily a role I would put him in. And
I don't think that he pulled it off.
No, and placing him opposite bubbly Anne Hathaway, where he is so much more kind of laconic and kind of stone, kind of relaxed, mellow, kind of a vibe. It was just made him look kind of grumpy and cranky next to her. Like, it wasn't a good fit at all either. So I don't know. Maybe it was all again. Maybe that was just performance art. Maybe it was just an experiment. Like, I think when he was asked about it, didn't he say something like, "Well, they asked me if they were silly enough to ask me to do it. Why wouldn't I do it? You know, like it's an chance to do something weird and different, and broaden my range or whatever." Yeah.
I mean, I admire his willingness to be like, "I'm going to try this, even though it's not my comfort zone."
Right. There's a fearlessness there, if nothing else.
Certainly.
All right. Well, let's get to our picks. What's your first James Franco pick?
My first James Franco pick is a film that he directed, and we've mentioned he's directed a few films, among them a documentary about Saturday Night Live,
mm-hmm.
a film about Sam Neill, a film about Hart Crane,
right,
and a film about the leather bar scenes in Cruising. But this is probably his most coherent film-like film, though it's still somewhat experimental. It is As I Lay Dying, which is available for rent on iTunes, Vudu, YouTube, Hitlist, and Sony. This film screened in the Uncertain Regard sidebar at Cannes this year. And it's definitely the most whole of his films, though it's, of course, as is often been the case of the subject matters he's chosen, it's difficult subject matter. It's based on William Faulkner's novel, which is of the type that is largely considered unfilmable. It's written in stream of consciousness style. It's narrated by 15 different characters as they go to bury family matriarch Addie Bundren.
And Franco's like, unfilmable sounds great.
Right, sign me up. It's also, of course, considered one of the great novels of the 20th century. And he's aligned himself often, or at least expressed a lot of public interest in classics, right? Even if they are difficult. So the trick that he kind of pulls off here is in creating the sense of this being told from shifting perspectives by using split screen a lot. I would say probably 75% of the film is shot in split screen. The split screen, the both sides of the screen, including looks usually within the same screen. So even if they don't necessarily match up coherently, an example early in the film is that one side of the screen shows the daughter sitting at her mother's deathbed, looking towards the camera where someone's come in the door. The other side shows who's come in, Franco, who plays one of the main characters, Darl, and we hear him say something, but we don't see him. His lips don't move. It's almost as if it's hard to say whether this is a conversation that's a flashback or if it's something that's kind of happening in one of their memories. But there's a lot of this kind of slipperiness
in which it's almost dreamlike, which really suits the source material, in which oftentimes the characters, since they're all telling these monologues in their head, they're often more eloquent than they are in person, because they're supposed to be basically poor country folk.
Gonna die, Joe. Our mother. Addie Bundren's gonna die.
The dark current runs. Fading swirls move along the surface for an instant. Silent and permanent. Profoundly significant. As though something just beneath the surface has waked for a moment.
But basically, this is a story of them bringing their dead matriarch, Addie, the mother of most of the characters, to be buried where she says she wanted to, in this town that's about a day's ride away. And her husband, played by Tim Blake Nelson, has his own reasons for wanting to do this. Meanwhile, all of his children kind of basically suffer over the course of this very difficult journey, over which the body starts to rot as well. And as much as it doesn't entirely work, I have to say, this is a pretty admirable attempt at, and a pretty solid one, at bringing a work that's not really inherently visual to screen. I was pretty impressed by it. And Franco has the rights to The Sound and the Fury, another Faulkner novel that supposed to work on next.
Okay.
And I actually, it doesn't fill me with dread. That news does not fill me with dread, because he actually hit on something interesting in this one. I should also point out, in addition to Franco, who's probably the weakest of the actors in it, and Tim Blake Nelson, who does a very good job, the film also co-stars Logan Marshall Green from Prometheus, as well as Danny McBride in a small role. So, the plus side of being an actor is you can cast all your fancy friends in your movie. So that's As I Lay Dying. It's available for rent on most of the usual suspects.
I liked one phrase you said there towards the end, Allison. I think this could be like Franco's, the name of his memoir, which I'm sure he will write, a pretty admirable attempt. you don't always like what he does, but you always kind of admire the spirit in which it was made, right? That seems to be a way to sum up a lot of what he does. So my picks for this episode, we've already mentioned how James Franco plays James Franco a lot. And I decided for my picks, I was just going to do those kinds of things. Just pick things where James Franco playing himself. And the first of them is something I had never actually seen before this podcast, but is really one of the strangest things he's ever done, which is saying something because it's James Franco and everything he does is strange. But this was when James Franco appeared on General Hospital. And this was not a case where he did like one episode of General Hospital or a two-episode guest spot. He recurred as a character for several years, Allison. He kept going back. He would film a bunch and then his character would kind of disappear for a while and he would come back again. That's like over the course of 3 years he appeared on this show. And he played Franco. Not necessarily James Franco, but he played Franco, this artist type. But it is clearly designed as a character that is meant to represent a side of James Franco, or at least one of these like air quotes James Francos that he can use to explore these ideas. And there's an interesting profile of Franco that you can find online that was originally in New York Magazine. It was written by Sam Anderson. And he describes what's kind of interesting about James Franco on General Hospital at one point. So I'm just gonna read what he says here. He says, the part fit nicely into a constellation of ideas Franco had already been thinking about. The difference between high art and mass art, the space between performance and real life, the vagaries of taste. So Franco called General Hospital, one of TV's most popular and long-running soap operas, and the result is a small, double-edged pop culture masterpiece, a black hole of publicity in which everything works both within the frame of the show and as a commentary on Franco's career. So that's the quote there. So yeah, basically, he had the idea and he went to General Hospital and pitched it to them. This wasn't even a case of them looking for a guest star or asking him. He had the idea and brought it to them, and they liked it. And there is something really weirdly watchable about these episodes. It's not a goof. I mean, it is sort of a goof too. But, you know, he's playing an artist who is interested in death and basically is obsessed with one of the other characters on General Hospital. And Allison, I've never watched General Hospital, so I can't really I don't really get all the connections between the characters. And what you can find on YouTube if you look for this are someone went to the trouble to sort of edit Franco's scenes together. So you can watch an episode that's just his scenes. You know, it ends up being like between like 10 and 15 minutes, I think, or thereabouts. But what he's doing is really kind of fascinating and bizarre, you know? I mean, the first couple of episodes, it's like his art gallery, but he's willing to destroy the art that he could sell. And then he's talking about art. You know, he says, like, at one point, he says to this woman who he's interested in, he's like, the best art is understood by the fewest number of people. Which, again, could be, like, the name of a James Franco memoir someday. But it also probably is, like, him addressing why he's doing this, maybe.
You know Jason Morgan?
Not yet. Tell me about him.
He's one of Mr. Quinto's associates. They're coffee importers.
I love coffee. Introduce him.
Oh, I don't know if that would be such a good idea. See, Jason's not what you would call user-friendly, and he doesn't know anything about art.
The best art is understood by the fewest number of people.
Oh, okay. Well, you're incredibly popular. Does that mean you're not very good?
I'm good. But he may be better.
He's not an artist.
Look again.
He's got the look.
I want to meet him. Make it happen, or I will.
You're welcome, and you owe me.
You know, it's kind of cool how he's smuggling in these really highbrow ideas about art into General Hospital, and he's doing it while also kind of fulfilling all the roles of General Hospital, where he's still, you know, it's soapy, and he's got this relationship with this woman, and, you know, I found it really interesting stuff. I really have to say, I thought it was really kind of fun to go through these on YouTube. I had a blast doing it. Allison, have you seen? I know when it happened, you were definitely into it. I don't know if you
I've
ever watched it.
I've seen some clips of it, but I didn't keep up with it. But here's my – so I want to know, do you think that these ideas are really – has he brought actual complex ideas to General Hospital, or is he just talking about – big concepts that seem more sophisticated?
I think it's maybe closer to the latter, but I admire the fact that he's trying. Again, how did you put it before? What was it? It was the pretty admirable attempt. I mean, he's trying. You know, like, there's probably only so much you can do on General Hospital without, you know, getting people to change the channel. The idea is to kind of, I guess, smuggle the ideas in, or at least to get people kind of thinking about that stuff while they're also watching a soap opera. And I think he pulls it off. And the thing is, like, so many people, you know, there's cameos and things like that. People play themselves a lot in movies, right? But they tend to do it in a way where they're like, it's really over the top and outrageous. They play, you know, like, oh, they're a diva on the set, or they're really dumb, or they throw coffee in someone's face. It's like, it's not even like self-satire as it is just like living into cliches of Hollywood, you know? It's not even like satirizing Hollywood. It's kind of like embodying the cliches, you know?
Yeah.
And Franco's not doing that. He actually is interested in investigating this image, you know? If he's making fun of himself in this, he's doing it with such a straight face that the joke is like three layers buried beneath other stuff. I don't know. I found it really surprisingly compelling to watch, actually.
Well, my next pick is also a James Franco playing himself role. There are certainly a few out there. He's played himself quite a few times. And just his appearance in things sometimes is the joke. But this is Klaus and Greta, which is an episode from season 4, episode 9 of 30 Rock, which is currently streaming on Netflix. And this is an episode in which James Franco appears as himself and has his manager arrange to set up a fake relationship with the character Jenna, played by Jen Krakowski, in order to counter rumors that he is involved in a romantic relationship with a Japanese body pillow. Yes. It's, you know, it's not the first time Franco has taken a run at the various rumors about his sexuality, but this is a particularly goofy one involving the pillow, which is named Kumiko, and his the various things he said. One of his better lines is, objects are made by men and used for many purposes, but we never love objects, as he's trying to convince Jenna to be in this fake relationship in which they do 5 public dates a week and agree to 1 fight per month. But what I think is interesting about this performance, other than Franco's really gameness to just make fun of himself, is that it is this commentary on him as a sex symbol, which is something that, you know, he is, I guess, in his career, but he's undermined so much by just doing these strange roles or just by playing against that type, that in this case, he and Jenna are in this fake relationship in which she starts to get caught up in believing it's real because he's romancing her for the paparazzi. And so when he plants this big movie style kiss on her, she can't separate that from the reality that he is in a much weirder, has much weirder taste.
This is nice. Well, your hand feels like a pillow that's been in the microwave.
Thanks. Okay. Well, I'll see you tomorrow.
Wait. It's okay, you can stop. I was wrong.
What?
I thought it was a paparazzo, but it's just some loser taking a picture of his kid.
Oh, right. Of course. And that was fake.
Did you know paparazzo is singular paparazzi? Kumiko taught me that. I'll see you at dawn so you can get caught coming out of my apartment. I'll loan you a shirt. Try to look like you just got drilled. You know the deal.
But I think that there's something to that. And Franco's seeming discomfort with playing a traditional sex symbol that is interesting. Like, he looks much more alive on screen playing, you know, a Hollywood weirdo who ends up having a 3-way at the end of the episode with a surprising character. This the whole storyline is a little bit like the Troy McClure storyline in The Simpsons in his marriage, but it's a really funny performance, and in some ways he looks much more comfortable playing goofy in this way than I would say in something like Oz, you know, in which he's playing this romantic object for multiple characters. So it's a very solid episode of 30 Rock, and it's one of the more interesting Franco as Franco performances that I can remember. That is 30 Rock, Klaus and Greta, currently streaming on Netflix.
Okay, well, my last pick is, I guess, the most recent James Franco as James Franco performance, at least that I know. Although, who knows, in the time since this movie has come out, he might have made 3 movies, appeared, you know, in 4 stage plays, written a thesis, who knows? It's hard to keep track. But the movie is this summer's This Is the End, which was directed by Seth Rogen and Evan Goldberg. They were writing partners, of course, for a long time. They wrote Superbad and a bunch of movies. This is the first thing that they've wrote and directed together. And James Franco plays himself amongst a cast that is basically everyone is playing themselves, including Seth Rogen, Jay Baruchel, Craig Robinson, Jonah Hill, and Danny McBride, who's probably the funniest, I think, of the bunch.
Yeah.
I mean, he really gets the kind of the standout role. He gets kind of the best material, I think. But
and 2 really good entrance scenes.
Yes, he really gets a spotlight entrance that is really just one of the great, like, movie star entrances in recent memory. It's pretty fabulous.
And a functioning revolver from the movie Flyboys.
Old Faithful.
Jesus.
Thing's real. No, I kept this from the movie.
Yeah,
this is an actual revolver.
I see. Yeah,
Franco, that's very uncomfortable. Yeah. Could you put that down, please?
Loaded.
Love it. Awesome. Can you just put
I always keep
away?
My props.
That's really cool.
Always keep my props. I know how to handle it.
He knows what he's doing. I like this bit. I like it. I get it. Yeah, let me see.
It's real. It's heavy.
Let me see. I got
it. The movie is set at James Franco's house, quote unquote. Basically, all of these guys are over at Franco's house for a big Hollywood party with lots of drugs and stuff, and everyone's hanging out when the actual biblical apocalypse occurs, complete with the rapture and demons and everything. And essentially, after the chaos kind of dies down, a bunch of the guys, including Rogan and Baruchel, Franco, they all kind of barricade themselves in Franco's house and wait for help to arrive, which basically never does. And so it really becomes this chance for extended improv sessions on the idea of like writing out the apocalypse, basically, and like what would happen if a bunch of guys were kind of sitting around waiting for the end. And there's some great comedy bits, including one with Franco and Danny McBride over the right to possess the like one porno mag in the house. They're like arguing over it in a really kind of incredibly profane way. And again, it's James Franco playing James Franco. But I mean, there are some jokes that kind of are pointed at the typical, you know, making fun of ourselves kind of thing. But, you know, it's interesting to compare his performance to someone like Michael Cera in the movie, right? Who plays Michael Cera as, like, crazy, coke-snorting, you know...
Womanizing.
Yeah, promiscuous, kind of like, almost like abusing women. Like, just so over the top that it's like the joke is, well, he's not like this at all, right? Whereas the Franco approach here and elsewhere is more like to kind of actually play like what we think of him as. Like, no one thinks of Michael Cera as a coke snorting, you know, promiscuous, you know, jerk. But we do kind of think of James Franco as this like rich weirdo who does all kinds of crazy stuff.
And would have a house
and would have
terribly pretentious art.
Right. That's exactly what I was going to say. This weird kind of ugly modern house with weird art. And he like willingly lets himself be made fun of in a way that is like, it cuts at him instead of like, in a way that bounces off him. Like, the Michael Cera jokes are funny, but we don't ever think for a moment that we're seeing the real Michael Cera. Like, James Franco gets at something that's kind of more interesting and fun, in that he seems to be playing a less fictionalized James Franco. You know, whether it is or not, he indulges our desire to see the real guy, right? And to play against that, which is something I admire. And also to come off, like, genuinely badly, whereas someone like Michael Cera is doing it so over the top. Like, even, like, the way, like, the final fate of his character kind of makes James Franco look bad, you know? Like,
yeah.
Petty and kind of a jerk, which,
well,
again...
He's like, the forces of evil in the basic storyline, right? Like, he is the Hollywood douchebag side seducing away Seth Rogen's character.
That's right.
From his actual best friend.
That's right. The sort of the theme of the movie beneath the whole apocalypse thing is the idea that Seth Rogen and Jay Baruchel used to be friends, closer friends anyway, and that Seth has kind of sold out and gone Hollywood, and he's drifting apart from Jay, and Jay feels like he's losing his friend and doesn't fit in anymore. And the reason is because Rogen is hanging out with Franco too much, essentially.
Yeah.
Seducing him to the dark side of Hollywood. So, yeah, again, yeah, he's kind of the non, like, demon villain of the movie. You're right. Which, again, is kind of awesome. And it is also just a super funny movie. So, if you haven't seen it, it's available now on Amazon, iTunes, Google Play, and YouTube. And it is called This Is the End.
Morning.
Who are you?
My name's Aileen. My real name's Al, but... truth be told, I ain't from this planet, y'all.
Alien?
That's what they call me.
Why are you here?
I saw y'all in there. They like nice people. Thought maybe I'd bail you out. Everyone could use a little bailing out once in a while.
Why?
Why not? Come on, y'all. Why acting suspicious? Get in.
Where are we going?
Go wherever you all want.
Cotty.
Got the right idea? Come on. I'll be your chauffeur.
Give me a chauffeur.
Yeah. Y'all can play Beyonce.
All right, it's time for our listener's choice review. First of all, let me just say, we haven't mentioned it yet. You might hear once again... sound quality, not quite as perfect as we like to have it. Once again, we're recording over Skype, Allison, the rabies hasn't cleared up yet, huh?
No, I'm still biting people. The foaming, it's hard for me to resist. They look so delicious.
The foaming at the mouth hasn't subsided yet. No. Although I offered to just, you know, have like a cloth that you could dab your mouth with, but you said that was
some sort of health hazard,
like, I guess.
You were having to wear body armor to come over. It just seemed a little too much to ask for you.
Right. But yeah, so hopefully, we said it last time, but hopefully on our next episode, you'll be, you know, you'll be back to full strength and we'll be able to record together. But we had to do it the Skype route one more time, but hopefully it still sounds pretty good. I listened to the last episode with it and it sounded okay to me. It didn't sound terrible. So hopefully this is all right. But hopefully, again, it's just a temporary thing. So with that said, let's get to our listener's choice review. And on our last show, you guys chose Spring Breakers. It got 55% of the vote over Russian Ark, which got 30%. And Michel Gondry's Is the Man Who Is Tall Happy, which only got 15% of the vote. So grab your string bikinis and your hot pink ski masks. It's time to head to Spring Break. The film here was directed by Harmony Korine, who's made some of the stranger movies of the last 20 years, including Mr. Lonely, which was about a melancholic Michael Jackson impersonator, and he made Trash Humpers, which is, as advertised, about people who hump trash. Spring Breakers probably has to be his most commercial work to date. It's also, I think, his most successful. It's made $30 million worldwide, which for a $5 million movie is not bad, Allison. It's actually been pretty successful.
Oh, that's impressive.
Yeah. And part of the appeal, part of the box office draw, I'm sure, was Harmony Korine's very canny casting of Disney icons like Vanessa Hudgens and Selena Gomez, and then letting them take a sledgehammer to their wholesome images by doing drugs, robbing chicken shacks, and generally just shooting bullets into most of Western Florida. And now I'm not sure if James Franco's role as Alien counts as stunt casting. He's playing a small-time rapper and drug dealer who bails the girls out of jail and then Svengali's them into the ways of the gangster life, although he's not playing James Franco here, so I don't know. For him, this may actually just be a regular role, but it's certainly attention-getting nonetheless. So the movie has several commercial hooks, like all those actors. It's got beautiful day-glow cinematography by Benoit Deby. But these are all, Allison, these are all superficial pleasures. So my question to you, Allison, is amongst all of these commercial hooks, this superficial pleasure, did you find anything beneath the surface of Spring Breakers?
No, that is the question, isn't it? I wrote when I first saw this film at South by Southwest that I don't know where the air quotes go.
Mm.
And I feel watching it again, I'm still not sure. It is a film, maybe it's the perfect James Franco film in this way, in that it moves between irony and sincerity in ways imperceptibly. I don't think you can pick a single moment and call it one or the other, but it seems to be powered by both of those forces simultaneously. And it is, you know, in theory about girls who all come from this, the relatively privileged background of going to college, right?
Mm-hmm.
Who go to spring break and then stay too long at spring break. They actually dabble in criminality, right? But then all of the sentiments that they express about, everyone's gone, but we're stuck here. You see the same things every day. I don't know. Is that supposed to be a heartfelt emotion being expressed? I can't tell. And I don't think I believe it. I really am a little befuddled by this movie. I think that it tries to do something I really can't pin down. And I feel like watching it, I'm halfway between being like finding it very compelling and also finding it just this exercise in, I don't know, like self-mockery almost, or mocking the audience. And I really don't know where I fall between that. What about you?
Yeah, we're pretty much on the same page. You know, I saw it for the first time at South by Southwest as well. And I think we mentioned on the last show, I wasn't in the greatest of health. I was kind of in a daze and a fog when I saw it. And I kind of expected to have a lot more clarity when I went through it this time. And I almost feel like I understand it less this time. I don't necessarily dislike watching it. The experience of watching it is interesting and pleasant. And certainly thought-provoking at times, but I also am having a lot of trouble pinning down, like, what is actually going on here? Is it a satire? Is it a celebration? Is it an indictment? What is it? All of those things in one, I guess. Its meaning, its ultimate meaning, at least to me, is kind of ambiguous. And I think to some degree that's to its credit. It's certainly a text that invites – you can't just watch it. I guess you could, but I can't just watch it and turn my brain off. I'm constantly kind of weighing what I'm seeing and thinking about what Corrine is trying to say. But I have to admit that I wish there was just a little bit more clarity there, that I had a little bit more of a better sense of what he was going for. And, you know, watching it this time, when again, I thought I would kind of come out of it with a much clearer view, I almost felt like I understood it better when I was in this kind of hallucinogenic state myself. Maybe that's the way it's supposed to be, enjoyed or interpreted or watched anyway. I mean, the movie is very dreamlike and very kind of elliptical, and by the end of it, very nightmarish as well. And I wonder if it's almost meant to be watched under the influence of some kind of substance. I mean, I'm not sure if there is sort of a clear point or message that's supposed to be taken away from it. It may be more of an experiential thing that you're supposed to kind of drift away on these sometimes horrific and sometimes quite beautiful and sometimes simultaneously both images. Maybe that's the big point.
Yeah, I think the kind of key moment in the movie is when they sing the Britney Spears song on the beach. And
right.
It's this gorgeous setting, right? It's this like pink sunset as they're on the beach, the piano there overlooking the ocean. And Franco sings with total sincerity. His character Alien sings the song by Miss Britney Spears, little known pop star.
Right.
And they all join in. And then the real track takes over and we see the characters brutally robbing other spring breakers as the music kind of swells. And it does seem like the key to the movie, but in a way that is not helpful at all in terms of understanding it.
Right.
But it's certainly, I think, the most powerful moment in the movie. And throughout the movie, the idea of spring break as this place, it is this kind of dreamlike place, right?
Yeah.
We know that they're in Florida, but have no idea where.
And I think it's St. Petersburg or somewhere around there.
Yeah. But it's kind of the way it works is almost.
Well, there's certainly
the logic is deliberately very fuzzy. Right.
And most of it, almost all of it is shot in slow motion. There are very few shots that seem like normal speed or, everything is slowed down, kind of fitting with the dubstep music. Like it's just like this haze of. And the swirl of slow motion images, but yeah, as to what they're adding up to, I don't know. But I mean, the images really are so striking. I mean, those the shots of the women in the bikinis with the ski masks with the Uzis, or that that great Britney Spears sequence where, and then again, the scenes where in that sequence where they're robbing people, which are all in slow motion. And there's this amazing shot of Franco jumping on a bed in slow motion, and his dreadlocks are whipping in the air, and he has this incredible gleeful smile on his face. There's something kind of wonderful about it, even as what they're doing is absolutely objectionable and horrible. But what to make of it is something I think we're going to have to keep
yeah.
wrestling with.
So the art critic Jerry Saltz at New York Magazine, he was actually writing about Kanye West's Bound 2 video in
right.
which he's on the motorcycle. But he wrote something that I thought about in conjunction to Spring Breakers. So I'm going to read you a passage here. He says that he thinks it represents a part of a collective cultural fracturing via an idiom I call the new uncanny. When performers like Kanye West, Kim Kardashian, Lady Gaga, and yes, Jeff Koons and Marina Abramovic try so hard to showcase and communicate how sincere they are, instead they reveal how out of touch they are from each other, from themselves, from us. These are not just famous performers, they are performers of fame. In their grandiose sincerity, their attempt to keep it real,
Wes says his passion is for humanity, and his art is totally about beauty, truth, awesomeness. These stars become alien things, automata, odd gods before our eyes. By some bizarre alchemy, they then toggle back into demented sincerity while simultaneously remaining alien, other, apart. They become psychological quantum particles in two states at once. Sincerity and fame combine, float free of common rules. Now, obviously, Harmony Korine is not a star in the way that we would say Kanye West is, but his performers are in this.
Right.
He has picked performers who all have this weight of stardom to them. And I do think that in some ways, the film is aspiring to capture this idea in the same way, which is that you have three, you know, Disney stars, Disney princesses, really, you know, of the kind of these like giant franchises enacting this very vague kind of approximation of college students wanting to get away from it all. Mm-hmm. And it becomes a strange, extreme, but at the same time, like attempted sincere take on that. And there is some weird power to that divide that I thought it applied in some ways.
I mean, it's getting at that idea of like how much of this is a joke and how much of it is meant sincerely, and can it be both at the same time? And it is. It's like if there is a joke here, it's really hard to pinpoint and nail down. I mean, there are some of those great scenes with James Franco, like where he's touring us around all of his stuff with his shorts in every color and his dark tanning oil and all this. I mean, that scene is really funny. Just because of how wonderful Franco's performance is. And I think in general, his performance here is really terrific and incredibly memorable and quotable and one of the best things he's done in a while. But I mean, what is the joke there? What am I like, other than the fact that it's just so wonderfully, outrageously over the top performed, like what is he making fun of there? Capitalism, consumerism. I don't know.
I feel like if he is, it's a very cruel comedy,
right?
You know, to make fun of this kid who grew up poor and has made all of his money through a life of crime, and now has collected all of the usual tropes of that you attach to either hip hop stars or to criminals,
right?
Including a Scarface poster,
right?
So if that's the joke, it's not a very nice one.
Right.
It's a very easy one.
Right, exactly. But to me, the movie complicates it by kind of making us like that character. I mean, there's something...
Yeah, he's the tragic figure.
Right, and there's something very kind of charming about him at times, you know? And him, you know, the way he, you know... He certainly is, like, seducing these women to the quote-unquote dark side. But there actually isn't anything, like, sinister about his motivations necessarily, right? Like, he just likes them and wants them to kind of join in, you know what I mean? It's not like he's thinking of, you know, it's not like he's trying to kidnap them and sell them into, I don't know, slavery or something. He likes these young women, he thinks they're attractive, and finds, eventually he says he loves them, that they're his soulmates, you know, like...
Right, and what's sad about him is that he, like... We understand that all of the girls will eventually go back to school,
right?
They all eventually decide they've been at the party too long and it's time to go back to school. But he lives in spring break forever.
Right,
he
as
no,
he says.
No normalcy to go back to.
As he says many, many times, yeah. But there are some, you know, there's some really good scenes in this movie. And I think Franco is great. Again, I still can't quite formulate what it all means, but there's something there that I kept kind of coming back to and thinking about, and I couldn't quite get out of my mind. I mean, I think as you can see, as like it's a movie that I've got a lot of thoughts about, but not very coherent ones.
Yeah, and I don't know that it necessarily has one particular underlying agenda. I don't know that Korine could say the movie is about this one thing. You know, I don't know that he's that type of filmmaker even. I will say this. The song Every Time, which is the Britney Spears ballad that they sing
yes.
at the piano, is a song that Britney supposedly wrote in response to her breakup with Justin Timberlake. And it is a song about her like heartbreak and plea for forgiveness for hurting Justin Timberlake, supposedly.
Okay.
And I think what's interesting about that choice of the song is that here you have this pop star – you know, composing this like simulacra of an intimate revelation that at the same time is all based on very public knowledge about this public relationship, that, you know, then these characters sing and the listeners are also supposed to relate to. And I think kind of there's something to that as well about this deeply like kind of emotional commitment to an emotional experience that actually no one can relate to. Mm. Like, who can relate to Britney Spears and whatever happened to her with Justin Timberlake, you know?
Right.
And I feel like there's something that maybe to me is how I feel about the movie, which is a combination of like, it's like a deeply sincere expression of an emotion that I think is impossible.
Right.
That and I can't relate to at all.
And it's a deeply sincere joke too. Like there, right. Yeah, that's, yeah. Well, if anyone has a grand theory of how, you know, it's all about Britney Spears and Justin Timberlake, they should send us an email
please,
explain it all to us. Because I think as we've said here, you know, there's something here we like, but we don't know quite what it is. So we're still wrestling with it. But I feel like it's a fun movie to wrestle with. It's one I wouldn't mind wrestling with again at some point down the line. I certainly will continue to quote James Franco's character for many, many years. Shorts in every color is not going away anytime soon. So that is Spring Breakers, and it is available now for streaming on Amazon Prime. All right, let's wrap things up with our Behind the 8-Ball segment, where we count down three new titles on streaming, two listener recommendations, and one film chosen blindly by number from our My List. Right, Allison?
Yes.
Yes. Allison, you're going to go first.
Yes, I am.
Are you ready to go?
I am ready.
All right. How about we start with three new releases?
All right. First up is The Angel's Share, which is new to streaming on Netflix and is the latest film from the great director Ken Loach. One of his slightly softer films, kind of like the recent Looking for Eric, though no film from Ken Loach is without its social commentary and a bit of gritty realism, and certainly this one has that as well. It's a Scottish comedy about a man who just escaped going to prison. He's instead on community service. He's trying to turn over a new leaf after a history of some violent crime. And then he turns out to have a great nose for whiskey, for fine whiskey, and discovers a cask of like very priceless whiskey is being auctioned off. And in it, he sees the possibility for escape into a new life. And that is currently streaming on Netflix. Also new to Netflix is Sightseers, which is a film from Ben Wheatley, the director of The Kill List, Down Terrace, and most recently A Field in England. This is a dark comedy about a couple who go on a camper tour of the British countryside and who start murdering less polite fellow travelers. It's kind of a relationship film as killing spree. So that's also on Netflix. And finally, new to Hulu is A Film Unfinished. This is a 2010 documentary from Yael Herzansky about a unfinished German propaganda film entitled The Ghetto, which depicted the Warsaw Ghetto 2 months before the mass killings there. And for a long time, it was used as a kind of flawed record of what life was like in the ghetto until they discovered another reel that showed outtakes demonstrating how much the scenes were staged to kind of show the callousness of the people being depicted.
Hmm.
And so the film becomes this really great, inquiry into the idea of what we take for granted in terms of seeing, like, truths that we take for granted, including a moment where five actual survivors of the Warsaw Ghetto are invited to view the footage, and their reactions are filmed. So it's a very unusual film, A Film Unfinished, which is new to Hulu.
Okay, how about two listener recommendations?
Okay, first up is from Elroy from Melbourne, and he writes, "For me, one of the year's best films has been The Reluctant Fundamentalist. With The Reluctant Fundamentalist, Mira Nair challenges us to create our own thoughts, emotions, and feelings about September 11th and the weeks, days, months, years following it. Many questions were raised, but maybe what Mira Nair was really trying to say with this film was that the people of America were not the only victims of 9/11. The flags whom the forces responsible of 9/11 hide behind are victims too. Intelligent films like that just reel me in like a fish taking the bait. I loved it, and best of all, I watched it on demand. In the U.S., it is available via Showtime on Demand if you have Xfinity, so you can check it out there. And our second recommendation is from B. Trench, who writes, in terms of good streaming picks, there's been a lot of 2013 catch-up on my end. Just watched Drug War, now available on Netflix. Strongly recommended, as it has more thrills and engaging sequences than in many Hollywood films from this year. Plus, it's the best way to get into Johnny To's films for those who haven't really seen any of his work. And he writes that it throws in another recommendation that he also saw Pieta from Kim Ki-duk. Really messed up film that isn't for everybody, but the late night Friday, Saturday gorehounds will appreciate it. A very selective piece of cinema from a provocative filmmaker in the ranks of Harmony Korine or Lars von Trier. So that is Drug War. That is available on Netflix.
Okay, and how about one random film from your my list?
You gave me number 41, which is one of those films I've had for a long time on there. It is, it's actually one I can't believe I've never gotten around to seeing. Citizen Ruth.
What? Alexander,
I know. Film starring Laura Dern, you know, as a chemical huffing woman who turns up pregnant, becomes the center of a giant pro-life, pro-choice media circus. Satirical film about the whole abortion debate. Yeah, I've never seen it. And considering it's Alexander Payne, that's terrible.
I am shocked.
Yeah.
Shocked, yeah. And appalled.
As you should be.
Mm.
Well, Matt, are you ready?
I don't know if I can come back from that. I'm so rocked. I'm rocked to my very core, Allison.
He is shattered.
I am shattered. All right. I think I'm ready.
All right, three new films.
Okay, well, I'm going to start with the film Prince Avalanche, which is streaming on Netflix. It's the new film from David Gordon Green, who returns to his indie roots after years of big-budget Hollywood movies with this very charming, low-key film about a couple of guys, played by Paul Rudd and Emil Hirsch, who they're working on this quiet little country road after it's been destroyed in a forest fire, and it's just a lovely little movie with great performances. I think, you know, that there are things that you can read into it about it being a kind of a metaphor for David Gordon Green's career, which I think is very interesting to kind of ponder as well. But Rudd and Hirsch, above all, are great, and there are some really, really lovely sequences. And just a nice little movie worth checking out. So that's Prince Avalanche, available on Netflix. Also available on Netflix is a documentary about a world that I just find endlessly fascinating, which is the world of pro wrestling. This new documentary is called Glow, The Story of the Gorgeous Ladies of Wrestling, which is about this short-lived women's pro wrestling promotion that was hugely popular in the mid-1980s and then died out completely a few years later. The reasons why potentially are addressed in the film. The whole thing may have been a tax write-off for a rich guy. It may have been basically an infomercial in disguise. Basically, this like billionaire funded the whole project. He was a guy who owned a lot of products and companies, and he would package the programming with the commercials already built in and then sell them to stations. So it was essentially like a very entertaining infomercial. But the documentary, it's brief. But it's a nice overview. It has a lot of heart. You get to see a lot of the women from the Federation from back then and what's become of them and how important a role it played in their lives. And there's some very touching stuff in it as well, actually, because, you know, some of them have lived hard lives after fame, as a lot of pro wrestlers do. And we get to see them. They basically have a reunion in the film. That's sort of the structure of it. And we get to see their reunion, and there's some very touching moments there as well. So that's Glow, The Story of the Gorgeous Ladies of Wrestling. That's available on Netflix. And finally, another new documentary on Netflix, this one called Our Nixon. And it's about the world of the Nixon White House. The backstory here is that some of Nixon's aides, including H.R. Haldeman and John Ehrlichman and Dwight Chapin, spent a lot of time filming what was going on in the Nixon White House on Super 8mm home movies, and they shot all this footage, and it basically just sat on a shelf in some archive for decades. No one ever found it, no one ever used it, and then this documentary filmmaker, Penny Lane, found it and assembled this film out of the archival materials. There are interviews in it, but all the interviews are archival as well, not from these Super 8 movies, obviously, but sort of interviews they've done over the years with, you know, different news outlets, different other kind of TV documentaries, PBS, what have you. And it gives you this very unique perspective on the Nixon White House. I mean, there is stuff in it that's, if you're familiar with the stories, you'll be familiar with this. They play some of the Nixon audio tapes, you know, like the secret tapes from his office, of course. So some of it will be familiar, but just the footage itself, the Super 8 footage of the Nixon White House, I think is so unusual and well worth watching all by itself that it more than makes the film worthwhile. So that's Our Nixon, and that is also available on Netflix.
Okay, two listener recommendations.
All right, our first is from Pete. Pete recommends The Many Adventures of Winnie the Pooh, the 1979 film made up of three short films that made Winnie the Pooh a household name in the United States, which is now streaming on Netflix. It's sweet, harmless fun, full of joy and honey. My favorite scenes are the first few. Pooh does his stoutness exercise. Pooh climbs and floats up a honey tree. There are a few missteps. Pete says, I find the Heffalumps and Woozy's dream sequence a little out of place. But if you're looking for a movie that the whole family can enjoy, especially kids who aren't ready for violence, check it out. So that's The Many Adventures of Winnie the Pooh. And slightly more adult material from a listener, Andrew Willis, who says, the movie I am recommending is Walter Hill's first film, Hard Times. It's about a quiet drifter who gets involved in bare-knuckle street fighting, and he's looking to make enough money to get by. His new manager is a gambling addict who's out for the big score. Charles Bronson plays the boxer, and James Coburn plays his manager. Bronson's protagonist is nearly mute. He's unquestionably a precursor to characters like the driver from Drive, and probably also the driver from The Driver, which is another Walter Hill film. The film opens in the back alleys of Chicago before it moves and spends the majority of its time in New Orleans. In many ways, the film reminded me of The Cincinnati Kid with Steve McQueen, and also reminded me a little of the legendary film Cockfighter starring Warren Oates. The fight scenes are pretty good, and the overall direction is very strong, especially for a first-time director. Andrew says he watched this movie on Crackle, and it does have a lot of commercial breaks, but it was worth it. Hope you enjoy the film, and I love the show. So that is Hard Times, which is streaming on Crackle, and that was a recommendation from Andrew.
All right, and one from your My List.
You gave me number 5 on my List, and this week, that is The Iceman, with Michael Shannon playing real-life mob hitman named Richard Kuklinski, who, according to the description, killed more than 100 people for the mob and his own pleasure between 1964 and 1986. Despite his prolific violence, he was a devoted husband and father of two daughters. Besides Shannon, the cast includes Winona Ryder, Chris Evans, Ray Liotta, David Schwimmer, Robert Davi, and James Franco. James Franco! So it all fits back together in a perfect way. This one I put on there recently because it's Michael Shannon. I love Michael Shannon. Generally, he's an actor for me that makes even bad movies worth watching. So I was curious about his performance here. I watched a few minutes of it. It didn't look like the most promising movie, but Shannon looked pretty interesting. So I am going to watch the rest of it. So that's The Iceman on my List on Netflix.
Well, that brings us to our new Listener's Choice section. In the next episode, we'll also be doing the Swoovy Awards for the end of the year, but we will be doing a main review as well. And we've got 3 picks for you this time. The first is one that we've already mentioned. It's Prince Avalanche, David Gordon Green's, it's not even his latest film at this point, he's very prolific, but Paul Rudd and Emile Hirsch as two guys repainting traffic lines and considering the solitude and their own relationship. And, you know, always interesting to see the work of David Gordon Green, who's done films like All the Real Girls and films like Pineapple Express. His work has spanned great distances. So that is available on Netflix.
All right. Our second pick is going to be available for rental on iTunes starting on December 17th. And it's called Prisoners. It's directed by a man named Denis Villeneuve. Stars Hugh Jackman, Jake Gyllenhaal, Viola Davis, Maria Bello, Terrence Howard, Melissa Leo, and Paul Dano doing what he does best, Allison, getting the crap beaten out of him. It's a film. The plot description I got here says a story. It's about a story that poses the question: how far would you go to protect your child? Hugh Jackman's character is facing every parent's worst nightmare. His six-year-old daughter goes missing, together with her young friend. And as the minutes turn to hours, panic sets in. The only lead is a dilapidated RV that had earlier been parked on their street. Heading into the investigation, the detective, played by Jake Gyllenhaal, arrests its driver, played by Paul Dano, but a lack of evidence forces the only suspect's release. Knowing his child's life is at stake, the frantic Jackman decides he has no choice but take matters into his own hands. So kind of a dark, very dark psychological thriller. Neither of us have seen this one yet. Got pretty good reviews this year.
And, yeah, I know some people were very enthusiastic.
Yeah, I've seen it popping up on a few top 10 lists. And this is one that I wanted to catch up with, haven't had a chance to yet. So I was pushing for this one. So that's Prisoners, and it's going to be available for rental on iTunes.
I should also point out that Denis Villeneuve directed Encendi, which was one of the most, you know, really acclaimed films not a few years ago. So, interesting filmmaker. And our last pick is from another interesting filmmaker, if a challenging one. It is Post Tenebris Lux, which is currently streaming on Netflix, the most recent film from Carlos Regadas, the Mexican filmmaker behind Battle in Heaven and Silent Lights, two kind of highly acclaimed festival films that are very divisive, particularly Battle in Heaven. This is a semi-autobiographical but also incredibly surreal film. The best description I could find of the plot is Juan and his urban family live in the Mexican countryside where they enjoy and suffer a world apart. And nobody knows if these two worlds are complementary or if they strive to eliminate one another. So make of that what you will. Regadas won the Best Director Award at Cannes in 2012 for this film and was also booed. So it's that kind of film. The kind of film that wins awards and also gets some hearty boos from the audience. And that is available on Netflix.
Okay, so which movie should we review on the next episode of Film Spotting Streaming Video Unit? Send your pick to SVU at filmspottingsvu.com or enter in the poll on the right-hand side of the page at filmspottingsvu.com. Your vote must be received by Monday, December 23rd at noon. After that, we'll announce the winner on our Twitter account, twitter.com/filmspottingsvu, and you'll have all that week to watch the film and then join us for our conversation, as well as the Svoovies, on our next episode on Tuesday, December 31st. It'll be a special New Year's edition.
FilmspottingSVU.com is also where you can find our show archive, as well as a list of direct links to all the movies we discussed on the show. The Film Spotting SVU remix theme song is by Vince Vandal. You can listen to more of Vince's work at vincevandal.com. And we will be back in 2 weeks with more movie recommendations and the movie review you pick, along with the Svoovies. And in the meantime, you can follow us on Twitter at Allison Wilmore and at Matt Singer. And you can follow the show at Filmspotting SVU. That's, of course, where we announce the winner of each show's listener's choice and where we share more streaming suggestions from you, the SVU listeners. For Filmspotting SVU, I'm Allison Wilmore.
And I'm Matt Singer. Thanks for listening.